Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is.
From VOA Learning English, this is As It Is. I'm Anna Mateo. Today's As It is all about farming and food, something we can't live without. A report shows that industrial farmers may be making growing conditions more difficult for themselves. But first, we talk about the weather. There's an old joke. When you don't know what to talk about, you talk about the weather. But when weather affects how much you spend on food, or even if you have food, then people actually want to talk about the weather. And people in the U.S. are talking about California's lack of rainfall, or drought. Record low rainfall in that state could affect food prices in America. And like a rock thrown into a pond, it could have a ripple effect on food prices all around the world. Here's Katie Weaver with more on that story.
In the Central Valley of California, farmers are reducing crop size because they do not have enough water. Last year, California had the least amount of rain since officials began keeping records. And it may be just as bad this year. Reservoirs are areas where water is stored. In California, some reservoirs are empty. The amount of snow in the Sierra Mountains is 75% below normal. This mountain snow melts in the spring and fills rivers. The water is used by farmers. But now farmers are warning of the possibility of another dust bowl like the one of the 1930s. Severe droughts and dust storms covered American farmlands, and few crops grew. Farmers in California produce almost half of U.S. fruits and vegetables. Much of it comes from the Central Valley. Dan Irataberry is a third-generation California farmer. He grows tomatoes, walnuts, garlic, and other crops in Fresno County. He says the federal agency that controls the amount of water released from dams and rivers has stopped giving him water. He and other farmers say officials are not correctly administering the water system.
The last couple of years, dry years, including coupled with severe environmental restrictions, has now presented us with a zero allocation year.
Farmers may not be able to plant crops on more than 200,000 hectares of farmland in the Central Valley this spring. Mr. Irataberry will plant crops on just 80% of his farmland. He has enough work for only 15 of his 25 workers. Federal and state officials sometimes reduce the amount of water to farmers, even in years with normal rainfall levels. The officials must supply water to the Sacramento River Delta, which is home to several endangered species. Long-term solutions include conservation, recycling wastewater, and building desalinization centers. These centers remove salt from seawater so it can be used on farms. Farmers say better administration of the state's water system could also help solve the crisis. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Anna Mateo. You are listening to As It Is. Agriculture is, by its nature, dirty. But it is also dirty. Industrial agriculture produces a lot of greenhouse gases that scientists link to rising temperatures and climate change. And climate change can hurt growing seasons, and that hurts food supplies. So if industrial agriculture wants more production, it had better clean up its act. Karen Leggett has more on a report that looks at farming practices and their effect on growing crops.
The World Watch Institute in Washington says high temperatures and unpredictable weather are disrupting agriculture in many parts of the world. It suggests ways that the agriculture industry could reduce its own effects on the environment. The report is called Innovations in Sustainable Agriculture, Supporting Climate-Friendly Food Production. Danielle Nierenberg from the research group Food Tank was one of its authors.
Because industrial agriculture tends to be very resource-intensive, it uses a lot of fossil fuels, it's a huge contributor to climate change. Anywhere from 25 to 30% of all greenhouse gas emissions come from the agriculture sector. If you look at all the ingredients that really go into making food, fertilizers, pesticides, antibiotic use, transportation, processing facilities, all of those things are very dependent on fossil fuels.
Ms. Nierenberg says animal production has an especially big effect on the environment. She notes that the amount of meat being eaten in countries like Brazil, China, and India is growing. As a result, more industrial animal facilities or factory farms are being built in the developing world. Those big farms need fossil fuel inputs to operate, and they require long-distance transportation, she says, so all those things can contribute to climate change. The report recommends 6 land and water use practices that it says are sustainable. These include growing trees on farmland to reduce soil erosion and planting cover crops to make soil less vulnerable to drought, heat, and pests. Ms. Nierenberg says urban farming can help as well.
Growing more food in cities can reduce transportation costs, so urban residents can buy very locally from rooftops or backyards in their community. So you're reducing transportation, you're making a city more green and helping sequester carbon so that it's not just a concrete jungle, but a place that really supports food production.
Other recommended practices include recycling wastewater in cities, drip irrigation, and catching and storing rainwater. Another recommendation is to replace chemical fertilizer with animal waste. I'm Karen Leggett.
And I'm Anna Mateo. And that's As It Is for today. Has the weather affected food prices where you live? Have your food bills gone up recently? What about the farming industry in your part of the world? Tell us about it all in our comments section. And join us tomorrow for another As It Is.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English. From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. It has been nearly 3 years since President Barack Obama announced what has been called the Asia Pivot. The term describes increasing attention on East Asia and the Pacific after reducing American involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. This week, President Obama left Washington for a week-long trip to 4 Asian countries. The trip aimed to restate U.S. support for the security of Asian allies and for reducing trade barriers among Pacific nations. Mr. Obama arrived in Japan Wednesday at a time when a number of allies are concerned about China's military expansion. Many Japanese have noted the failure of the Obama administration to act on its threats to attack Syria. They have seen the administration's unwillingness to provide military aid to Ukraine. The Japanese are worried that the United States may not come to Japan's aid. On Thursday, the president said the U.S. would honor a defense treaty with Japan if China seizes a disputed group of islands. The islands are known as Senkaku in Japan and as Diaoyu in China. Mr. Obama spoke after talks with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe.
The treaty between the United States and Japan preceded my birth, so obviously this isn't a red line that I'm drawing. It is the standard interpretation over multiple administrations of the terms of the alliance, which is that territories under the administration of Japan are covered under the treaty. There's no shift in position. There's no red line that's been drawn. We're simply applying the treaty.
But in Beijing, a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman noted that nothing has changed. The official said the Diaoyu Islands are China's inherent territory, and the country would protect its sovereignty and maritime rights. At his meetings in Tokyo, President Obama urged Japan to speed up talks for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The partnership would create a free trade zone among Pacific countries. The negotiations were slowed down over Japanese taxes on agricultural products. On Friday, the U.S. president was in Seoul for talks with South Korean President Park Geun-hye. At a joint press conference, Mr. Obama said America would never back away from its promise to help South Korea. He also said the two countries will stand shoulder to shoulder against any incitement by North Korea. Earlier, he gave a warning to the North against carrying out another nuclear test. After 2 days in Seoul, Mr. Obama will visit Malaysia and then the Philippines. Territorial disputes with China and U.S. military cooperation will again come up for discussion. This is President Obama's 5th visit to Asia since taking office in 2009. Susan Rice is his national security advisor. Speaking before the Asian tour, she presented the trip as a chance to declare U.S. focus on Asia and the Pacific.
Whether it ought to be viewed as a containment of China, I would say this trip has a very positive, affirmative agenda, and that's how we are looking at it, as an opportunity to solidify and modernize our alliances and partnerships, as an opportunity to advance our economic agenda.
And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Our story today is called The Purloined Letter. It was written by Edgar Allan Poe. Poe is generally known for his horror stories. This is the third of three stories he wrote about Auguste Dupin and how he solves crimes. The story is about a stolen letter. It first appeared in 1844 in a yearly magazine. It was reprinted in many publications, newspapers, and books. This is one of Poe's stories that influenced the development of the modern detective story. Here is Shep O'Neill with The Purloined Letter.
One evening in Paris, during the autumn of 1845, I went to visit a friend, Auguste Dupin. We were smoking our pipes and talking when the door of his apartment opened. Mr. Germain, the head of the Paris police force, came into the room. "I came to ask your advice," Germain said to my friend Dupin. "I'm trying to solve a very important case. It is also a very simple case, so I really need your help. But I thought you would like to hear about it, because it is so strange. My men and I have worked on this case for 3 months," Germain said. "It is a very simple case of robbery, but we still cannot solve it." Dupin took the pipe out of his mouth. "Perhaps the mystery is too simple," he said. Germain began to laugh. "Too simple," he said. "Who ever heard of such a thing?" I looked at Germain. "Why don't you tell us the problem?" I said. Germain stopped laughing and sat down. "All right," he said. "But you must never tell anyone I told you this. The wife of a very important person needs help. I cannot tell you her name, because her husband is a powerful man in the French government. Let us just call her Madame X. 3 months ago, someone stole a letter from Madame X. She is offering a large amount of money to anyone who can return the letter to her. We know that her husband's political enemy, Mr. Darcy, stole the letter. We also know it is somewhere in his apartment. Darcy plans to use the letter to embarrass Madame X's husband and destroy his political power. As you know, I have keys which can open any lock in Paris. For the last 3 months, my men and I have spent every evening looking for the letter in his apartment, but we cannot find it." Dupin stopped smoking. "Tell me how you looked for it," he said. Germain moved forward in his chair. "We took our time," he said. "First, we examined the furniture in every room. We opened all the drawers. We looked under the rugs. We searched behind all the paintings on the walls. We opened every book. We removed the boards of the floor. We even took the tops off the tables to see if he had hidden the letter in the table legs. But we cannot find it. What do you advise me to do?" Dupin puffed on his pipe. "What does the letter look like?" he asked. "It is in a white envelope with a red stamp," Germain said. "The address is written in large black letters." Dupin puffed on his pipe again. "I advise you to go back and search the apartment again," he said. About 1 month later, Germain came back to see us. "I followed your advice," he said, "but I still have not found the letter." Dupin smiled. "I knew you would not find it," he said. Germain became very red in the face. "Then why did you make me search the apartment again?" he shouted. "My dear Germain," Dupin said, "let me tell you a little story. Do you remember the famous Dr. Louis Abernathy?"
"No," Germain shouted. "Get to the point, Dupin."
Of course," Dupin said. "Once a rich old man met Abernathy at a party. The old man was not feeling very well. He decided he would get a medical opinion from the doctor without paying for it. So he described his problems to Abernathy. "Now, doctor," the old man said, "suppose you had a patient like that. What would you tell him to take?" "Oh, that is quite simple," said Abernathy. "I would tell him to take my advice." Germain looked embarrassed.
"Look here, Dupin, I'm perfectly willing to pay for advice."
Dupin smiled at Germain. "How much money did you say the reward was?" he asked. Germain sighed.
"I do not want to tell you the exact amount, but I would give 50,000 francs to the person who helps me find that letter."
"In that case," Dupin said, "take out your checkbook and write me a check for 50,000 francs. When you have signed the check, I will give you the letter." Germain looked at Dupin with his mouth open. His eyes seemed to jump out of his head. Then he took out his checkbook and pen and wrote a check for 50,000 francs. He gave it to Dupin. My friend examined the check carefully and put it in his pocket. Then he unlocked a drawer of his desk, took out the letter, and gave it to Germain. The policeman's hands shook as he opened the letter. He read it quickly. Then he put it in his pocket and ran out of the room without saying a word. "Dupin," I said, as I turned to my friend, "how did you solve the mystery?"
"It was simple, my friend," he said. "Germain and his policeman could not find the letter because they did not try to understand the mind of the man who stole it. Instead, they looked for the letter where they would have hidden it. Mr. Darcy is not a policeman. He is, however, very intelligent. He knew the police would search his apartment. He also knew how police think, so he did not hide the letter where he knew they would look for it. Do you remember how Germain laughed when I said the mystery was difficult for him to solve because it was so simple?"
Dupin filled his pipe with tobacco and lit it. "Well, the more I thought about it, the more I realized the police could not find the letter, because Darcy had not hidden it at all. So I went to visit Darcy in his apartment. I took a pair of dark green eyeglasses with me. I explained to him that I was having trouble with my eyes and needed to wear the dark glasses at all times. He believed me. The glasses permitted me to look around the apartment while I seemed only to be talking to him. I paid special attention to a large desk where there were a lot of papers and books. However, I saw nothing suspicious there. After a few minutes, however,
I noticed a small shelf over the fireplace. A few postcards and a letter were lying on the shelf. The letter looked very old and dirty. As soon as I saw this letter, I decided it must be the one I was looking for. It must be, even though it was completely different from the one Germain had described. This letter had a large green stamp on it. The address was written in small letters, in blue ink. I memorized every detail of the letter while I talked to Darcy. Then, when he was not looking, I dropped one of my gloves on the floor under my chair. The next morning, I stopped at his apartment to look for my glove. While we were talking, we heard people shouting in the street. Darcy went to the window and looked out. Quickly, I stepped to the shelf and put the letter in my pocket. Then, I replaced it with a letter that looked exactly like it, which I had taken with me. I had made it the night before. The trouble in the street was caused by a man who had almost been run over by a horse and carriage. He was not hurt, and soon the crowd of people went away. When it was over, Darcy came away from the window. I said goodbye and left. The man who almost had an accident was one of my servants. I had paid him to create the incident. Dupin stopped talking to light his pipe. I did not understand. "But Dupin," I said, "why did you go to the trouble of replacing the letter? Why not just take it and leave?" Dupin smiled. "Darcy is a dangerous man," he said, "and he has many loyal servants. If I had taken the letter, I might never have left his apartment alive."
The Purloined Letter was written by Edgar Allan Poe and adapted into Special English by Donna DeSanctis. The storyteller was Shep O'Neill. The producer was Lawan Davis. You can read and listen to other American stories at our website, voaspecialenglish.com. I'm Barbara Klein.